This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with a series called Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews of 2004. We continue the series with David Sedaris. Like many of his fans, I first fell in love with his writing when he read his story, Santaland Diaries, on NPR's Morning Edition. That now-famous piece told about his experiences working as an elf in Macy's Santaland. Ira Glass had produced Sedaris for Morning Edition, and when Glass started his own show, This American Life, David became a regular. Now David Sedaris is a literary phenomenon. He's written several bestsellers collecting his humorous personal essays and stories. He reads to sold-out theaters around the country. His bookstore appearances often have lines around the block. When he got famous in America, he moved to Paris, where he could barely speak the language. Now he also has a place in London, where it's a lot easier to understand what people are saying to him. David Sedaris' latest bestseller is a book of stories called Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. When I spoke with him in June, I asked him first to read a story from the book called Hejira. The title comes from a Joni Mitchell song.
It wasn't anything I had planned on, but at the age of 22, after dropping out of my second college and traveling across the country a few times, I found myself back in Raleigh, living in my parents' basement. After 6 months spent waking at noon, getting high, and listening to the same Joni Mitchell record over and over again, I was called by my father into his den and told to get out. He was sitting very formally in a big, comfortable chair behind his desk, and I felt as though he was firing me from the job of being his son. I'd been expecting this to happen, and it honestly didn't bother me all that much. The way I saw it, being kicked out of the house was just what I needed if I was ever going to get back on my feet. "Fine," I said. "I'll go. But one day you'll be sorry." I had no idea what I meant by this. It just seemed like the sort of thing a person should say when he was being told to leave. My sister Lisa had an apartment over by the university and said I could come stay with her as long as I didn't bring my Joni Mitchell record. My mother offered to drive me over, and after a few bong hits, I took her up on it. It was a 15-minute trip across town, and on the way we listened to the rebroadcast of a radio call-in show in which people phoned the host to describe the various birds gathered around their backyard feeders. Normally the show came on in the morning, and it seemed strange to listen to it at night. The birds in question had gone to bed hours ago and probably had no idea they were still being talked about. I chewed this over and wondered if anyone back at the house was talking about me. To the best of my knowledge, no one had ever tried to imitate my voice or describe the shape of my head, and it was depressing that I went unnoticed while a great many people seemed willing to drop everything for a cardinal. My mother pulled up in front of my sister's apartment building, and when I opened the car door she started to cry, which worried me, as she normally didn't do things like that. It wasn't one of those I'm going to miss you things, but something sadder and more desperate than that. I wouldn't know it until months later, but my father had kicked me out of the house not because I was a bum, but because I was gay. Our little talk was supposed to be one of those defining moments that shape a person's adult life, but he'd been so uncomfortable with the most important word that he'd left it out completely, saying only, "I think we both know why I'm doing this." I guess I could have pinned him down. I just hadn't seen the point. Is it because I'm a failure? A drug addict? A sponge? Come on, Dad, just give me one good reason. Who wants to say that? My mother assumed that I knew the truth, and it tore her apart. Here was yet another defining moment, and again I missed it entirely. She cried until it sounded as if she were choking. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." I figured that within a few weeks I'd have a job in some crummy little apartment. It didn't seem insurmountable, but my mother's tears made me worry that finding these things might be a little harder than I thought. Did she honestly think I was that much of a loser? "Really," I said, "I'll be fine." The car light was on, and I wondered what the passing drivers thought as they watched my mother sob. What kind of people did they think we were? Did they think she was one of those crybaby moms who fell apart every time someone chipped a coffee cup? Did they assume I'd said something to hurt her? Did they see us as just another crying mother and her stoned gay son, sitting in a station wagon and listening to a call-in show about birds? Or do they imagine, for just one moment that we might be special.
Gee, David, thanks for reading that. That's a great, great story. My guest is David Sedaris, and he just read the story Hejira from his new collection, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. When this actually happened to you and your mother explained to you why you were really thrown out of the house, did you think about the possibility that your parents had just had this big fight about you and about how to handle you?
And I did, and I suppose I was surprised that I was so unaware of it happening. But I was just in front in the rocking chair in the basement listening to that Joni Mitchell album, so all kinds of things could have been going on and I wouldn't have been aware of them. But I never felt that panic that, oh my God, they're throwing me out of the house and they're never going to talk to me again. Because my father's the kind of guy who you can have an argument with him and he can even throw you out of the house, but a couple hours later he's forgotten about it. I mean, he doesn't have Alzheimer's or anything, but he has a really, just this wonderful ability to put things behind him. And I've always been very impressed by that. So my dad got upset that I was gay and he threw me out of the house, but I was back a few days later.
So how did he react to you being gay after that first reaction of throwing you out?
Well, I was never like a slut. You know, I mean, I was never like the kind of guy who dragged people home or wore T-shirts. I was never that kind of a homosexual. And my dad, I thought that he was used to the idea, but I have a dear friend named Evelyn who lives in Chicago, and gee, I've known her for 20 years. She's 10 years older than me, and when I got out of college, I lived in her house for a while. And 5 years ago, I was talking about Evelyn. My dad said, "She's a great gal. Why don't you marry her?" And, well, A, I'm gay, and B, she lives in Chicago. I mean, there are like 18 reasons why I wouldn't marry her, one of which is I've been with Hugh for 13 years. But he's making an effort. When my dad calls, he'll say, "Put Hugh on the phone." And then Dad doesn't quite know what to say to Hugh, but you know, it's a nice gesture. He won't be one of those people that wears a T-shirt that says, "I'm so happy that my son likes other guys." He won't go that far, but he comes to accept it.
You know, in the story you just read, when, you know, after your father tells you you have to leave the house and you don't know why he's telling you that, you don't realize it's because you're gay, you say, you're thinking, someday you're going to be sorry. Did you ever have the desire of throwing that back in his face, of saying, "Well, Dad, this is how unenlightened you are, or this is how mean you can be," you know, at an opportune time when you needed to get even with him about something?
I did, but I always felt it was third rate. Like, I always felt when I yelled at my father, or if I said, I remember once I said, "You're going to die alone." And I felt like
very
I was being
nice.
So prophetic at the time. Uh-huh. And now I think back on it and I think, God, parents just must, it must be so heartbreaking to be a parent and hear your kid say something like that. Mm-hmm. Something so unoriginal. I mean, if they said something original or something thought-provoking or funny, it might be okay. But you would just want to say, "Oh, God, I said that same thing to my parents, you know, and, you know, surprise, you're going to die alone too."
David, a lot of the stories in this book are set in your childhood or in your teen years. And I'm wondering if it was like a conscious choice to spend some time writing about that part of your life, or whether this is more coincidental.
I think it's more coincidental. I'd been writing a lot for Ira's show, This American Life, and he throws out a theme for every show. And so sometimes the themes just happen to work best. If I looked over the scope of my life, they happen to work best in childhood. But I didn't consciously. I think if I was conscious about it, I would try to get away from that. I think there are so many traps to fall into when you write about childhood.
What are the traps?
Well, I think you can. There's a tendency to make yourself seem more clever than you were. And I was not a clever child at all. I was not a well-read child. I think I was just the kind of a child that I think you'd think, "Damn it, that's my son? That has to be my son?" You know, like sometimes you see someone with an ugly baby and you think, And you think, they must look at that baby sometimes and think, damn it, I wish I'd slept with somebody else. And I always felt like that, you know, like an ugly boy who's not necessarily clever and not athletic in any way, and just a general all around. You just think, oh, maybe he'll grow up and move away from home. That would be the most that you could hope for.
You've said that when you were young, you didn't read a lot. Did you write?
No, I wrote in high school. I had to write papers, and it was just, like, horrible for me. And I was like most people. I put it off until the night before the paper was due, and there was no sense of style to it whatsoever. And I wanted to be a visual artist, but I don't have any talent for that. But I was still giving it a try. And then I was 20 years old one day, and I just started writing. Like, I didn't know the day before that I would do it. I just started writing one day. And at around that same time, I started reading everything that I could get my hands on. So I wasn't one of those people that... I wasn't a child who thought, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be a writer. It came as a complete surprise to me. And I think that's sort of heartening, that that can happen to anybody. You know, anybody can, maybe tomorrow. Like a couple of years ago, Hugh and I spent the summer in Normandy. And I discovered, I say discovered, but they already existed, spiders. And I am so incredibly interested in spiders now. And at this moment, at our house in Normandy, there's probably 800 spiders in the house. And there's one huge, it's a kind of a spider that's a shape, the size of an unshelled peanut with legs on it. The Tegenaria gigantea. And feeding these spiders and recording their habits and studying them under a microphone, under a microscope, it's changed my life. But I didn't know the day before, the day before I saw a fly into a web and be eaten by a spider, I didn't know that this would be a huge passion in my life. And I just think that's so exciting that we have that ability to embrace things that we don't even see coming. I mean, it really is. It sounds kind of corny, but it's a reason to live. And who knows what it might be next? I mean, I'd be surprised if all of a sudden I got into that foot boxing. You know, like that would be a real surprise to me. But who knows? There could be something tomorrow or... Well, actually, I have my hands full with the spiders right now. So, but something could happen 10, 15 years from now that might cause me to look at the world in a completely different way.
Oh, I know what you mean. That's wonderful to see it that way. What is it about spiders?
I think that... we have these webs hanging, like almost like a campaign bunting throughout the throughout the house. And it's a three-story house. And I never was really... You never really saw the spiders because they're back in their little... they live in a little cavity at the end of the... at the back of the web. But then I saw a spider. I saw a fly, and then I saw the spider come out and grab it. And it was fascinating. And then I just started catching flies to feed to the spiders. And at first I caught them with my fingers. The best place to get a fly is against a window pane. They get confused there, and so you can grab them. So for a while I was catching them with my fingers, but it was more practical. I started catching them in a jar, and then I shake the jar up like it's a cocktail, and I pour the fly into the web. And the fly lands, and he's sort of punch drunk for a moment. He's like, "What happened? Where am I?" And then the second he starts to move, the spider comes out. And I just, you know, it's like rooting for the Nazi in a Holocaust movie. It really is. It makes me feel bad sometimes. But, you know, these are flies. So I'm not going to, you know, they go out in the yard and they walk through feces and they come in and dance on the furniture. I mean, if anyone has it coming, it's flies. And I think more than the spiders, it was catching the flies. It just fit into this obsessive... it was like an obsession that has been waiting for me all my life. I mean, it fulfills me completely. I will spend 6 hours at a stretch catching flies. And when we run out of flies in our own house, I go to the neighbors and ask if I can borrow some of theirs. So even more than the spiders, it's catching the flies. And the spiders in our house are full. You know, like, they're like, oh, not again. There's only so much that they can eat. But I love catching flies. Love it.
My guest is David Sedaris. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Sedaris. His latest collection of stories is called Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. When we left off, he was talking about his recent obsession with watching spiders and collecting flies.
Well, I know you see this new interest in spiders and flies as being an obsession, and you have described yourself in your writing as being obsessive compulsive. And you say something in one of the stories in your new book. You say something really funny about that. You say the good part about being an obsessive compulsive is that you're always on time for work. The bad part is that you're on time for everything: rinsing your cup of coffee, taking a bath, walking your clothes to the laundromat. There's no mystery to your comings and goings. No room for spontaneity. Now, here's something that amazes me. If you are so involved with routine and the kind of predictability of routine, the reliability of routine, how have you managed to move to foreign countries? You know, you moved to Paris. Now you also have a place in London. And in addition to that, you tour a lot. You go on book tours and you do maybe a city a day for a month or two. How do you deal with that?
Well, if my plane leaves at 7, right, then they're going to come and take me to the airport at 5:30. And I just get up at 4 and I write. And as long as I can write every day, then that's something I can do every day. I can take the other bits of it, right? So if I don't get to take a bath tomorrow, or if my suitcase is lost and I don't get to iron a shirt, I can deal with it because there's one thing that I can still do every day. I sort of like those tours. I mean, people always say, you get off the plane and then someone says, oh, you must be exhausted. And you think, oh, I am. Then you think, wait a minute, I haven't done anything. You know, I just took a half-hour plane ride. How exhausting is that in the scheme of things? So I like those tours. Because it feels like they feel like a business trip to me. They make me feel I never had a real job, so it never occurred to me that I would get to do that. And I just put it in my head that I'm a businessman, and I'm a businessman, and I'm on a trip for a month, and that helps me get through a lot.
I don't know if I ever shared this theory with you, but I've often wondered if your move to Paris. Well, let me put it this way. I know when you were young, you always wanted, I think I knew this anyways, that when you were young, you wanted to be well-known, you know, as a writer. The idea of being, you know, celebrated was something that you wanted. But as soon as you kind of got it, you left town. You left the country and went to a place where people didn't know who you were and you didn't even speak the language. And it always seemed to me almost as a way of intentionally or unintentionally, protecting yourself from being too well-known, protecting yourself against celebrity.
Well, I think, but that's something you can't really write about. You know, like if you write about somebody giving you, recognizing your name on your credit card and so giving you a free meal in a restaurant, you can't write about that. Because other people can't really relate. It didn't happen to them. And you can't complain about it because people think, what the hell is he complaining about? You know, I had to pay and leave a tip. So, and I think I tend to write better from the viewpoint of somebody who's having to struggle for something. And so therefore moving to France, it was just sort of starting over and having to, you know, asking for even the smallest thing. And now, having been there for 6 years, it's so hard for me to open my mouth. So I feel very foreign there. And part of it, too, is I think, you know, you grow up and you think, God, I would give anything if someone came up to me and said that they'd read something that I had written and that they liked it. And then when they do, you just want it to be over with. You know they mean well, but, you know, I just sort of dig the nails of my hand into my palm to make anything hurt more.
Why?
Than this. It's just, I mean, you want people to read what you've written, and you want them to enjoy it, and you want them to tell you about it. Actually, you want them to tell you about it. I think what you want them to tell your younger self, how much they liked it. Like the 20-year-old me would really appreciate it. And the 47-year-old me is just sort of embarrassed by it. There's a writer named Akhil Sharma who wrote a book called An Obedient Father. And it was the best novel that I'd read that year. Boy, it was just a magnificent book. And he came to my reading. And I know that I embarrassed him because I should have just gotten down and knelt on the ground before him. That's basically what I did, except with words. And I think that I embarrassed him. But at the same time, I needed to say that. I needed to say that I think that that he is probably the most inventive writer that lives in America right now. And that one of the reasons that I do not kill myself is the possibility that he'll write another book. And so maybe when people say nice things to me, I understand that they need to say it. And then you need to be gracious, and you need to, I guess it's just being embarrassed, I suppose.
David Sedaris, recorded in June. His latest book is Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.